Not quite one-fourth, and never just half, but the entirety of one primate, whole. It is the part of a story, an idea that means more to you than me. Hello and welcome to Full Gorilla Life. We are Jeremy Keene,
Larry Medina,
and Corey Hewlings.
Each week, we will break down an important life concept or talk with an inspiring person so that you can live your full gorilla life.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. In studio today, we have two special guests. One won't talk much, but the other one will, by the name of Mike Mertens. And Mike, thank you and welcome to the studio.
You're very welcome.
And Mike, if you could give us a little rundown of what your past duties were career-wise.
Well, you know, Larry asked me to come in today because we talk a lot with neighbors. We talk a lot about what we've done in the past. Before I moved to Florida, I lived in New York, born and raised in New York City my entire life. And I worked for 22 years for the New York State Division of Parole, but not in a usual parole officer capacity, thank God. I was assigned to our state division of our unit of warrants, assigned to work in New York City, the confines of New York City. So because of that, I had a really, really good job in a task force that was ongoing when I got there, along with the New York City Police Department, seeking out parolees who were in prison on felony charges, who decided for whatever reason that they chose to not report to their actual parole officer and just disappear. So they put warrants in, the parole officers put, and the judge put warrants in the system, came to our unit, and then the state guys and these city cops worked together as a team using most of the NYPD's equipment, by the way, which is okay, except the firearms, which were given to us. But and we went out and tried to get these guys. So when I first got down, it was very exciting, and I was assigned to a unit in the Bronx, Bronx Warrant Squad. And that was right out of the 4-2 precinct. It was adjacent to the 4-2 precinct. I was there for like 8 years. And then there was a little wave of transfers. And we and some of the cops went down back to Manhattan, in Manhattan Warrants, which was on 40th Street between 8th and 9th Avenue, virtually in the heart of Times Square, which was an exciting experience.
Sounds like it would be a lot of excitement there.
All right, before we get into that too much, I'm going to run you through the Gorilla Gauntlet, or I'm doing it off the top of my head, and Larry's going to correct me when I'm wrong.
Okay.
Married or single?
Married.
You have any children?
Yes.
Okay.
Three.
What city do you live in now?
Sebastian, Florida. Okay.
What was your first job, first paying job?
That I just run-of-the-mill job?
Just the first thing you did to make money. Okay. Like an actual paycheck, not pulling weeds for the neighbor.
Okay. I was an usher in a movie theater in Flushing, Queens.
Okay. How long did you do that
for? O'Keefe's. I did that for like a summer and an autumn. It was just far. I lived in Brooklyn. To get there, I had to take two trains and a bus.
Okay.
So it wasn't worth the $6 an hour. That was about
$3. How old were you?
I was 16.
Wow. Okay.
Okay.
It sounds like a lot, right, for a 16-year-old to have to travel.
Two trains and a bus. Yeah, that seems like...
excessive.
Actually, been to New York, actually just once, maybe twice now. I can't figure it out as an adult. Traveling around New York to me is like, is beyond me. We stayed...
There's an app for that.
Yeah, I don't think that we had an app at that time.
Maybe not.
Or maybe I just wasn't fluent enough to figure it out. But I think we stayed on the island or something because we had to take a train into the city every day. And it was like $40 each person to take a train into the city. So I was like, maybe that was round trip. It must have been $20 each way or something.
Well, from Long Island, it's probably very true.
Yeah. So, you know, I thought I was getting a better deal to get a 5-star hotel on the island instead of a 2-star in the city. I should have just got the 2-star in the city.
Yeah, because you can just stay out late.
I would never do it again. Like, absolutely never do it again. But anyways, that's either here nor there, really. But you just said two trains and a bus. I'm like, I would have been lost. We tried doing the subway, and I was like, I don't understand this. I was pretty sure I was going to end up in like Buffalo, New York or something.
No, the closest you get to Buffalo is the Bronx.
Okay. All right.
And God help you.
Yeah, yeah. This is true.
No. You have to also understand that, like, even going to, I went to Catholic high school. Where I lived in my neighborhood, I had to jump on the same train to go the opposite direction into Brooklyn, to Williamsburg, Brooklyn, to go to Catholic high school. So teenagers are very used to taking trains to go to, after they got out of elementary school, to go to high school.
It's just a different way of life. A good friend of mine grew up in New Orleans, and they used to get bus passes, like city bus passes, and they would like take the city buses to get to school. Exactly. And I'm like,
did the same.
Like, the school would every month hand out, he said, a sheet of bus passes to the students, and you'd have to tear it off, like perforated edges, and that's what you use to get on all the city buses to get to school. Exactly. I'm like, maybe it's just a different way. I mean, I had to get on that bus at my bus stop, and the yellow cheese wagon towed me to school, because I feel like if there was too many opportunities in between there and school, there's absolutely no way I would have made it. Maybe you just get used to it, and it's the way of life, I guess.
Well, yeah, you're right. I think, but back then, so long ago, I think the opportunities were, you know, not as plentiful as they are now to get into really bad trouble.
Yeah.
And if you did, and you got kicked out of high school because of it, Catholic high school, then I have to deal with my father, which I never wanted to do.
Okay.
So, so you pretty much try to keep it on a straight line until the weekend came along.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then we'll figure that out.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So,
go ahead. I got the last one, but I've already forgotten where I'm at.
Yeah, I figured. So are you an iPhone or Android guy?
I have an Android, yeah.
Okay. Favorite movie or book?
Shit. It's a book. Books. I'm a huge Hemingway fan. I have virtually all of his books. I can't put my finger on a book that I could determine as my best. What's the other thing?
Movies.
Scent of a Woman.
Really?
Hooah.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever watched it.
Hooah.
Every autumn I have to watch that.
That's a terrible Pacino impersonation.
I didn't even know what you were doing. I thought you were some type of animal call or something.
I am. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it is.
I've never seen that movie either, but I know the scene.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I watch it every year, virtually every year. When autumn comes, it's like a Thanksgiving themed film.
Really?
Yes.
It's almost like a Christmas Story on Christmas.
Well, I don't know.
He said, don't compare my good movie to your garbage.
It's a little darker than that. Yeah. It's a little darker than that, but it turns out good.
Okay.
So that's the whole, the end of the film is just absolutely just incredible.
All right, I'll have to check it out.
With Pacino's speech at the end of the film. It's just
okay. Now I really want to watch this movie.
So do I. But Pacino's just fantastic.
Yeah, he was blind in it too.
I know.
Yeah.
So it's just the end of the film is just, that really is.
That's what makes him say, hoo-ah.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe I do. It's based in New York City? Is it based?
Most of it, yes.
Okay. I think I've seen like a very small part of this. Yeah.
Just freaking great.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Hemingway, when we went to Cuba, Tom, that I'm pointing at right now.
Hold on. Tom is in the studio with us and he doesn't want to talk, but he's here for moral support and to pour the bourbon that everybody's drinking.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So we went to Cuba and we were in Havana.
Yeah.
And we went to Los Mundos, I think it's called, hotel, which is the bar, has like a rooftop bar where Hemingway supposedly like lived. And they actually had like a room, right? If I remember correctly, they had like a room that was like, or a floor that was specifically for Hemingway.
We went to like a few places that he was apparently a fan of, two different bars and a hotel where I guess he used to live, and they had like his room and stuff roped off.
Yeah.
And then they had the one bar where they had a statue of him.
Yes.
Like in the bar stool.
Yeah. I don't know why, but like it was awesome. Like
Do you think it was real though? Do you think he really stayed there or do you think it was
supposedly
like,
he lived there. He lived in Havana. He moved to Cuba.
Yeah.
He lived in the Keys for a while and then he ended up marrying somebody and then he moved to Cuba. But back then, I think everybody just kind of went to Cuba because it was like the thing before, you know, before Castro.
Exactly.
So, but all right. So, favorite genre of music?
I'm kind of eclectic when it comes to that. Whatever, you know, I'm the type of guy that my senses dictate what I like.
Okay.
Especially with music. I mean, I'm a huge music fan. I mean, lately, when I'm driving in a truck and stuff like that, I have this Sirius.
Yeah.
And, you know, I listen to a lot of really nice jazz on Sirius because as a kid growing up, even in high school, we used to listen to Stan Getz and Dave Brubeck and Thelonious Monk when I was 17 years old.
Thelonious Monk, okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
John Coltrane when I was a teenager. So that kind of stuff embeds itself in you. And even though you get later on into, like, you know, rocks, different genres of rock and Detroit music, Detroit soul, yep, which I love, I always flip back to make myself feel happy and good with really good jazz.
So, yeah.
This year, or last year, I guess, 2019, I finally went to Savannah, Georgia Jazz Fest.
Lovely.
And it's the first time that I've got to experience it. Like, I like listening to jazz, but, like, to sit in a huge park and listen to it, like, in better than spectacular weather, like, was an experience of a lifetime for sure. And, like, I can't wait to go back.
Beautiful.
Like, I had a good friend that I work with that just kept telling me to come. You got to come up. You got to come up. Got to come up. And I finally did last year. And I'm like, I can't believe I waited so long to actually go experience.
I'm going to have to go this year.
Yeah.
Well,
shit, I'll go with you.
It may not happen this year.
Well, let's cross that bridge.
When is this?
I'm with you on this.
September. I think it's the last weekend of September. It's a possibility.
Yeah, it's a possibility. I mean, yeah. We'll see. Yeah. It's either that or Bourbon Fest.
Where? New Orleans?
Louisville?
I don't know when that one is.
Yeah. It's in September, my birthday.
Is it?
Oh, yeah, because that's right. Because what's his name was there last year? Or,
Foo Fighters.
Foo Fighters was there last year.
You guys better tell me what's going on with that, man.
Yeah.
Don't leave me out.
We'll do. All right. So are you a reservation or just walk-in guy for restaurants? Or life?
It depends upon the restaurant. I mean, in Florida, I very rarely make any reservations. It just doesn't matter to me. Half the time you go to a restaurant, it's closed. You know, we're off for 2 days, 3 days, and it's like, I can't figure out why. In Manhattan, or even most of Brooklyn these days, yeah, I mean, if you want to go to a popular restaurant in Manhattan, you have to make a reservation probably a week or two in advance. But if you want to just go to a damn good restaurant in a local neighborhood in New York City, Manhattan, or Brooklyn, on a weekday, you could just stroll on up and probably they'll sit you down. But
Have you had Peter Luger's?
Yes.
And?
Peter Luger's is an incredible restaurant with beef. I mean, if you love the beef, man.
I do love the beef.
Their porterhouse will knock your socks off, and they have their tomato salad and cream spinach will linger in your memory forever.
Really?
But yeah, but the waiters are very rude, so you have to just, that's part of their shtick.
Is it really?
Oh yeah, they're real. Rude. They're real rude.
I did not know that.
Yeah, they are. If they don't know you, there's a lot of people who go there all the time. You know, kind of well known people. Yeah. But if you're like just a regular Joe and you make a resi and you go in there, and you sit down, and they're like, man, what do you want? They're all grumpy guys, which is, no, I'm serious, but it's good. It's fantastic food.
Okay.
I would recommend it to anybody.
So my next question is your favorite type of food?
Well, my mom was from Italy, so my favorite type of food is growing up in Brooklyn with Italians is Italian food.
It's going to be hard to beat.
It's pretty hard to beat. I mean, it really is my favorite.
So did she make like homemade pasta and stuff?
She did, especially the fancier pastas. Her and my grandmother both.
Uh-huh.
Gnocchis, and she made manicotti fresh.
Oh, my god!
Completely.
Gosh.
She made the little pancakes.
My mouth is literally watering right now. I'm on a paleo diet, so, like, no grains, no, like, nothing good. Don't let me rephrase that.
Why are you asking me this?
Well, I'm living vicariously through your memories, right? Vicariously living through your through your memories.
Yeah, right now he's waiting on just some meat from Chipotle.
Yeah, with meat on top of lettuce.
There you go.
Yeah, sounds like rabbit food with some dressing.
Yeah.
All right, so what do you drive?
Right now I got a Ram 1500 truck.
Have you always been a truck guy, or just since you moved to Florida?
Yeah, Florida. You can't have a pickup truck in New York City. It's just not going to work.
Yeah.
Did you even have a car?
I had a car. Yeah. I had to go back and forth to work. But it was always like, you know, never a used car until the very end before I left. It was always never a new car. We always got used cars because they get banged up real bad.
Yeah.
Streets are horrendous.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you have 12 feet to fit four cars in.
Like, exactly.
Yeah. People run into you, they leave. Yeah.
You can't help but play bumper cars.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I had a car in the city, but just to go back and forth to work. But down here, I drive this the Ram truck, and we've got a Jeep also for my daughter. So
are you like, were you excited to get a truck whenever you moved down here?
You know,
because I feel like it's a South thing, and not to say that Florida's really, I don't consider Florida really the South. It's just such a melting pot. You
we're
know?
Our own thing.
But I still feel like everybody still wants a truck.
Well, when I first got down, what I wanted more than anything was a Jeep, a Wrangler.
Okay.
No, with a rag top. That's just what I wanted, because you could not have that in the city, because God only knows. I mean, you come back and be in shreds, and everything you have inside is going to be gone.
Yeah.
You could bet on it almost. Yeah. So when I got down here, I got a Jeep, and I had that for about 6 or 7 years. After that, we had a couple of small cars, and I saw so many nice trucks around. I said, you know, what the hell, man? I just want to just get behind the wheel of these things and see how it really feels. So we got a used one first, and then I traded that in, got another one. I just traded the previous one in into a 2020 Ram with the big Hemi engine in it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'll tell you what, man, it's like driving a rocket ship, man. It's just one of the most amazing, comfortable vehicles I've ever driven.
Well, and new trucks don't drive anything like old trucks. No. You know, especially independent front ends like the newer ones have.
Yeah, I'm happy with it.
Yeah.
What do I have to lose in my stage of life? Let me enjoy a little bit.
I'm with you on this. Yeah. So last but not least, and I already know the answer to this, but beer, whiskey, or wine?
Well, whiskey's the top.
and then?
I drink red wine, occasionally white, but not usually red wine with my food only. I just can't sit down and drink a glass of wine spontaneously. It just doesn't work.
Okay.
But I got to eat something with it. That's because of, I think, my Italian background.
Yeah.
Okay.
And beer is beer on a hot, boiling hot day, and I'm really thirsty, and I'm sitting down on a river somewhere. Yeah, I'll knock down a bottle of beer somewhere, but not normally.
Gotcha. All right. So that's pretty much it. Those are all the questions that we really have for you. But now let's get into what got you going, right? So I know you because, like you said, you're my neighbor.
Yeah.
And you always have some good stories, you know. But regardless of that, before you were in the working for the state of New York, you were in the military.
Actually, while I was working for the state, I was in the Air Guard, Air National Guard simultaneously. I was in the active duty Air Force way back in the Vietnam days. And I got out and after 4 years and had a break for about 16 years. Then I just decided I was upstate living for going to school for a little bit. So I decided to get back into it. And I did. And the squadron was in Syracuse, a fighter squadron. So, and to me, it was like a boys club. You know, that's what back then it was peaceful, like the early 80s, nothing going on. They had nice airplanes, A-10s initially, and traveled all over the place.
What did you do?
I was a survival equipment specialist, which means that you got to be responsible for all the ejection apparatus that goes in the cockpit of a fighter jet.
Okay.
All the survival gear that goes into the seat. There's a seat kit underneath it where he sits on.
Yeah.
The parachute procedures, if he punches out, how to manipulate his parachute, how to get on the ground safely, and also how to use the equipment that's in his seat kit and also in his vest that he's got. And then that's pretty much where our duty ends.
I've always wanted one of those jet seats with the ejection chairs for a hot rod, you know. I've looked at them. I've looked at them on several occasions because every now and again they'll come up on eBay.
No.
But they're expensive to buy. Like
how much?
$1,500, $2,000 per seat. I mean, they don't have the ejection system in them anymore, you know. But
how cool would that be, though?
Oh,
if you're driving and it's a red light,
and you're gonna wreck, you just eject out the top.
I think that's genius.
I mean, you're really gonna like destroy somebody because you're not in there to hit the brakes anymore. So,
my God,
you should probably buy two of them.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's the problem is I want two because I want passenger and driver's seat to look the same. But $3,000 on seats has never really...
Yeah. Dude, it's just a frame.
Good, yeah.
Yeah. They look cool, though.
They do, yeah.
They look cool. They yeah. And they got the compartment underneath, like you said. Yep. Like, listen, I've looked at them. I know.
Yeah,
because I was like, Corey, you could put your CB radio under there and like everything. All kinds of cool stuff. Like,
variety of foods could fit in there. Yeah. All kinds of stuff.
Mike, if you know anybody that's got some laying around still, just hook me up,
You're on the top of the list, brother.
So what made you want to go into service, right? Because essentially you went in public service with being working for the state of New York and being in the Air Force.
Yeah.
So what made you want to do that?
Both those things?
Yeah.
Oh, I went to the Air Force when I was only 18 because I just wanted to get the hell out of Brooklyn.
They didn't draft you?
No.
Or no?
No. Okay. This was 1963.
Okay.
That's how old I am. So, I just want to get out. So I went in and stayed in there. Wound up going to Vietnam and came back and I finished that thing up. And then I got out. But then when I went back in the Guard, I just went in also because it was just a nice paycheck every month. These guys traveled around all over the world. That's what tactical fighter units do. And we went to great places. You know, Germany, I was never to Europe. I was only to Southeast Asia, which I didn't want to go back to. So, I went to Germany, different place, Norway, was nice. But then when Desert Storm started, the fun and games was over because our squadron, now we had F-16s, were tasked to go, one of the two Air Guard squadrons to go into Saudi Arabia to be part of the attack package to go into Iraq. So after that, I wound up in that freaking desert for like 6 months. So after that, the fun and games was over. So every 18 months, we deployed somewhere in the Middle East. So then I had to put up with that for a while. But
okay. So how many times did you get deployed over there then?
After Desert Storm, it was two more times to Saudi Arabia, once to Turkey, and once to Qatar in 2003 for the Iraqi war thing. So
okay.
With the F-16. So that was that. But all the time I was in the working my job. And they treated us great. They didn't take money from us. They paid us back when we got home. They allowed for all kinds of benefits still to go on. So I can't complain about anything that New York State did while we were deployed to places like that. In service, yeah.
So how long after you went back to the National Guard? Now, you weren't working in the Warrants Division at that point, right? Or for the probation and parole?
Parole. I was in graduate school at the time up in Binghamton, and I was talking to some friends, and I live in this town called Cortland, and we were talking about going into service.
That's near Connecticut, right?
Binghamton?
No, Cortland.
Cortland, New York is no, central New York, right in the middle of New York State, right in the middle, right below Syracuse.
Okay.
About 40 miles from Syracuse. So I just went up to the base and signed up. So then things worked out. I got out of graduate school, all this other stuff. I got a job up in Syracuse for a while. And then I took a test for the parole job and passed it easily. And wasn't that difficult, but with the veterans points and whatnot. And went down to, it was funny. We're sitting in a group in this big room in Syracuse and all these upstate guys. And so the guy from Albany was saying, hey, we got two really good street jobs down in Brooklyn. Anybody interested in that? Everybody's looking around. Nobody's raising their hand up. Nobody. these are like upstate guys.
Yeah.
So I went, ooh, I raised my hand. He goes, what's your name, mister? And so I told him, he goes, get up here and sign this piece of paper. 2 weeks later, I was back in Brooklyn.
Okay.
God's honest truth. So it was funny. So after that, that's when that really, that big crazy ride and with those guys began. So and I stayed 19 years with those guys.
Yeah.
So it was excellent.
So did you have a family at that time or kids or?
No, I was actually separated from my first wife. My two kids were, in college, my two boys. So I wasn't, I was just on my own. I went back down to the city and stayed with my cousin Joe, who's also a retired NYPD detective. And I stayed with him in his apartment until I found my own.
I gotcha.
And then later on, I met my present wife and on my job, and we got married.
So what year did you start with NYPD?
Working in the warrant unit? 89.
Yeah, whatever year, the 89, you started in the actual city?
Yes.
Yeah. So what was that like in 89? I got to imagine that was a different era.
It was crazy back then, right? Because isn't that when Times Square had like the house?
It was
like,
bad.
Right?
It was the crack was king.
Yeah.
Okay.
Crack. I mean, it was unbelievable, and I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I was away from it for a while. And Times Square was a mess. The mayor was, his name was David Dinkins. I don't know if you remember that name.
I do.
Okay. And he was a laid back kind of guy.
Apparently.
Yeah. And he wasn't, he was not really, I'm not going to say he was proactive with policing in the street, because he didn't criticize the police, but he was not proactive either. So there was a lot of crazy stuff going on. And when I got down there, there was just a situation where you could never go out by yourself. When I first got on the job, I was in a unit, a special offenders unit, to get your feet wet. And you had to, at nighttime, go and do a little surveillances and stuff and on people and visit them sometimes in the projects or something. And the projects, project life, public housing life in New York City is just unique in many ways, because they're centralized units that are constantly on alert for police invading their space. So it's hard to get a lock on that. I mean, if you roll up on front of a project, what you're going to hear is a bunch of whistles and hoots and that are signals that the cops are coming. So, and we all had plain clothes. So it wasn't as if...
You know, but they knew?
They know, of course. It's only because the neighborhoods were primarily black or Hispanic. So when you see a car roll up with three or four white guys in it,
makes sense.
They knew at least to be on alert.
On alert. And That's why the hooting and hollering went on. So it was rough. And they had a riot for a while in a place called Crown Heights in Brooklyn, where a black person and a Orthodox Jew got tangled up in some kind of stuff. And the black guy killed a Jewish guy. So now there was a big riot between the Orthodox Jews and the Crown Heights riots, they called it.
Yeah.
That was crazy. That's when...
Were you there during the Crown Heights?
Yeah, I was.
Because that's like history books type stuff, Crown Heights.
Yeah, I was right there. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's when Rudy Giuliani was elected mayor, because he stood up on the Brooklyn Bridge, front of the Brooklyn Bridge, and said, I could clear all this stuff out. I'm 1,000% behind the police department. This is not going to happen anymore. Your power is going to be reinstated. So he was elected mayor after that.
Now, in 89, when you started, do you know? I'm sorry?
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you remember or do you know how many were on the police force at that time?
You know, it's almost a static number. I probably, back when I started, it was probably like 33,000. Now it's about 40,000 cops.
Yeah.
In that city. That's a lot of cops.
I was talking to Larry about that. That's just mind boggling to me to think 40,000 police officers work for one department.
Yep. Yep.
And I mean, not to say that's not needed, because what do they have? 8 or 9 million people in the city?
Or yes. Yeah.
And I mean, the whole state of Florida has 21 million people. So, I mean, you're talking that little area has 8 or 9 million people in it. Like,
I think it's 11, actually.
Is it 11? Oh,
11 million, I believe. Somewhere in that ballpark.
Yeah. There now. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So, I mean, but the police department is broken up to so many precincts. Every borough has a whole nest of precincts all over the place.
Yeah.
And the good thing with that is, and we experienced that, I've experienced it myself when we got jammed up with gunfire and stuff like that, was that if you get on the radio and you call in in New York City, when there's shots fired and police are in danger or maybe even shot, it's a signal 1013. So when that happens, no kidding, you could wait 20 seconds, 30 seconds, and you hear sirens coming from every freaking direction. It's a beautiful thing, man. I'll tell you right now.
If you're in a fight, you're never alone. Yeah.
Yeah. You're never alone. And cops patrol always two at a time. I know in Florida, that's not always the case.
Yeah.
So, but you're never alone, and they come to you quick, especially if you're jammed up.
Yeah.
So.
Do you remember your first surveillance?
Well, the first surveillance, I do. It was on a horrendous sex offender. Can I mention his name?
He's passed on now.
Okay. His name was Carl DeFlumer. There's big articles about him in the New York Times and stuff. Carl DeFlumer. Carl DeFlumer grew up in Albany, New York, and he probably grew up psychotic. And what he did to go to jail was he took one of his male cousins and went out playing in the woods and hung him from a tree just so his feet were touching the ground.
Jesus.
Didn't kill him. He was touching the ground so he could keep his breath, but then he raped him when he did that. And then he finished off hanging him. So when that, he killed him. So then he went away as a juvenile, but they put him, he was like 17, I think, but they put him in population after a year or two in Dannemora State Prison, which is the worst freaking prison in New York State. Forget about Attica. Attica is, mythological. But Dannemora is the worst.
Yeah.
It's way up on the Canadian border.
Okay.
So he was up there for a long time. he got worse in there. He came out after like, I don't know, 15 years, 20 years, I don't know. He came out and he did the same thing again to a newspaper boy delivering papers to his house in Queens. And the cops found him in the act and they almost shot him to death, but they didn't at the time. And so he went back upstate, did another bid, and he came back to us. So at that time, I was, this is right before it was, I was doing warrant work and I was also monitoring some of the more aggressive, crazy parolees that were available, you know, that were released from prison because parole division is not that big. So, you know, the cops do it. The cops have a sex offenders unit right now that's always working. We were down there and me and my partner, Tony Pinheiro, we sat on him for days. And he was doing everything he's supposed to do. So one day he came into visit his police officer, the cop, the detective on the sex offenders unit, and I was standing there. He looked up at me. He goes, yeah, what are you? I said, my name is Mike Murrins. I'm a parole officer in the unit over here. I said, let me ask you something. Would you just empty your pockets? I want to see what's in your pockets. He goes, why? I said, why? I said, no, I'm at, you don't ask the questions. You know, I said, I want to see what's in your pockets. So he takes his, puts some change in his pockets and some keys, and he had a little small pocket knife. I said, whoa. I said, what are you doing with that? He goes, oh, I get passes to go see my family in Albany, and I use this to cut cheese and apples on the ride up. I said, you're not supposed to have a knife. He goes, but it's a small one. It's legal. I said, well, how do you know it's legal? Put him up against the wall. I handcuffed him. Put him in for that. And when the hearing came, I had to go to the hearing because I arrested him.
Sure.
Preliminary hearing. And so the hearing officer, the judge there, he goes, why'd you arrest this guy? I said, because he had a knife. He goes, but doesn't seem to be in the guidelines. I said, really? I said, you know this guy's history. It's not relevant. I said, it is relevant. It is relevant because look, this guy could easily cut a piece of rope, right, tie it around somebody's neck. But you can't really assume that. I said, fine. I said, because I don't know if we should hold. I said, you don't want to hold them. I said, sir, excuse me, Your Honor. I said, I don't know if you have kids or not, but you know what? If you want to release this guy and you got kids in the street, it's your choice. But if I were you, I'd think twice about that because this guy doesn't seem to repent. No, it's the truth.
Yeah.
So the guy was like looking worried, the judge, and he held him for a final hearing. So we went to the final hearing, and they upheld the search, the size of the knife, and they returned him back upstate for 10 freaking years. That wow. wasn't that. Yeah, it's the guy's honest truth. It was in the New York Times. He didn't stay 10 years. He got out after like 6 or 7. But you know, you have an impact.
Yeah.
Because there are some people. I mean.
Yeah, that's if that's the worst of the worst.
That's the worst of the worst. But if you have the opportunity, look, you know, if you have the opportunity to really, really drop a hammer on someone that is so horrifically.
Well, we've talked about that before on the show. Yeah. It's just, you know, there's a difference between people that do bad things and evil people.
Evil people, precisely.
Evil people.
Yeah.
When you look at them in the eyes, like you and see the actions that they've done, an evil person is. It's not even comparable to somebody that does bad things.
Yeah, if you do a bad thing, you fucked up once.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Somebody that's evil is willing to do things that are just unthinkable to a normal human. And I say normal, I use that word very lightly because I know what normal means. But
yeah, I mean,
it's unthinkable to most of society.
Exactly.
I'll say that, you know,
for somebody to do the same thing twice.
Yeah.
Like that's. That's evil.
I mean, to hang anybody, to have, you know, to just execute anybody by hanging is like, you gotta be, there's something twisted in your head anyways.
After raping them.
Yeah, and then that's not even counting the rape, you know. Like.
And that was your first one?
That was the first real hard case that I had to do surveillance on, you know, and when I started working down in the city. But after that, it was, virtually all of our cases were, seek and retrieve. You know, I mean, we'd roll out every day in a big van. We had a bunch of three or four vans. So you had three detectives, three state guys, our warrant guys. And we go out, we share the warrants, and we go off into the Bronx, which is the best place to work, I think. I love the Bronx. And then Manhattan, and you start hitting on doors at 4 o'clock in the morning, at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. And and getting in. And if you can't get in and we feel there's somebody there.
So did you work a night shift?
I work, well.
Or how does that work?
Night shift. Yeah, we did have night shifts. The actual day tour was like 4 o'clock in the morning. You show up at 4, quickly sign in, and then you go out, grab your stuff, and you go out and start running around. But sometimes they have what they call a G tour, which so you work at like 4 o'clock until midnight. Sometimes on a weekend, they let us for special circumstances to work on a weekend at nights from like midnight until dawn, because you're looking for a certain number of people who have been known to be denizens of the night at that time in the city, partying in some places, and you go out and grab them, which we did occasionally. So we grabbed a transvestite who was a vicious transvestite on 41st Street and 10th Avenue in this kind of transvestite club over there, and he put up a fight. So
now, the 60 you guys go out on a daily basis, where do you eat lunch? Do you always eat at the same spot?
Or? No, you know what? In the Bronx,
it's a very important decision of the day.
You're right.
It's very important. The most important decision of the day.
Especially in the city.
Deciding where to eat lunch. Yeah.
Now, I feel like in the city, you'd have a lot of options.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You have so many options. That's why. Did you get pigeonholed where you were usually at the same spot a lot? Well, or?
You know, in the Bronx, it wasn't easy because we had a lot of... We lived the 4-2 precinct. You ever see this film called Fort Apache, the Bronx? You ever see that film?
No.
No? I have it in the house. With Paul Newman.
Okay.
He's a cop. They filmed it in the 4-2 precinct because it's even tourist buses would go by and stop in front of this place, believe it or not. But the actual Fort Apache, the Bronx, was the 4-1 precinct, which is further away. But this one was more accessible to filming. It was like, you know, it looks like a typical precinct. So in that area right there, all you had were primarily Dominican or Puerto Rican restaurants.
Uh-huh.
That was it.
Yeah.
So, or McDonald's or some kind of crappy chicken, you know, fried chicken place, which, you know, you can't keep eating that stuff. And I mean, I love Hispanic food. My wife's a Puerto Rican. I love Mexican food, but there are virtually no Mexican restaurants around there at the time. No. After a while, it's heavy. You don't want
to. Yeah.
So
delicious, but it's heavy.
So yes. There were targets of opportunity. If you were in a different borough, if you were down Lower Manhattan, transporting someone down there, you'd stop in Little Italy to a great sandwich shop. Right?
Okay.
And then, or to a place that might make great falafels, which I love, or shawarmas. There's shawarma stands all over the street, so you could stop and get one of those.
Yeah.
So those are good.
What's a shawarma?
What's a shawarma?
Yeah, I don't know.
Do you guys know what shawarma is?
No.
Never heard of it.
Okay. This is a cultural issue.
Yes. I agree.
Even among the police departments of New York City. Okay. A shawarma, they're very, very popular in New York City. The little stands, the restaurants too. It's a Mideastern food. Okay.
Okay.
And it's like a big fat pita bread.
Like a naan?
Almost like a naan, yeah, okay. But it's thick. And they'll have this meat. It's a combination of lamb and beef and
like a gyro.
Yes.
Oh, you saying a shawarma is a gyro?
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
Very good.
Is it a hero?
Euro?
Euro? Gyro?
Shawarma. But they put.
I don't know
they
how to
put,
say it.
Yeah, shawarma. They put different stuff on it to make it more Mideastern. But it's. Greek food and Islamic food or Turkish food are virtually identical, or Israeli food.
I mean, really?
It is. Yeah. Okay. Virtually identical.
Yeah.
But shawarma. So shawarma, everybody loves a shawarma.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Tzatziki sauce.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Some cilantro thrown on top of that.
You can't eat that.
No, not right now. No, I can't. I'm actually thinking about the one that's, you know, have you had the Greek restaurant on US-1 here in Vero, Spiros or Spiros?
Not yet.
They do really good stuff.
I think it looks good.
Yeah. Yeah. They do really good stuff down there.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where the Hurricanes used to be down there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good place. Yeah. But Manhattan, we lived right, like I said, midtown. We worked right in midtown Manhattan, so right around the corner from us on 9th Avenue, Hell's Kitchen, they call it.
Okay.
Why is it called Hell's Kitchen?
Because I think that name stuck way back in the 20s and 30s when it was just a total Irish neighborhood. And the Westies, the famous Irish mob, were called the Westies, the Irish Mafia. They lived there, and they ruled that area. And it was very rough. And beat down and, iron-fisted and crime was high. So I think just because of the activity there, somebody came up with that nickname, Hell's Kitchen, but it was the turf of the Westies, Irish Mafia at that time. They're virtually all gone right now. But some of the bars are still around. So you could go in little dive bars, you know, pretty good. But over there, they had so many great restaurants right on 9th Avenue. I mean, Italian places, sandwich places, Asian places. So it was never a loss for something in Manhattan. But yeah, the Bronx was, you know, you get tired of eating beans and rice and... You do.
Yeah, you gotta you gotta plan your day around it though.
Yeah. Rellenos de papa.
Yeah. I like that.
That's good stuff.
But then your stomach starts grumbling, you gotta find a bathroom someplace. And when you're in hot pursuit, that ain't gonna work.
You're in hot pursuit of the bathroom.
Yeah, that's right.
Or they'll find you.
That's right.
Because you're leaving a trail.
That's right.
your code brown.
That's right.
Code brown.
All the way. All the way.
Hey, there went Mike. Yeah, Papa. Yeah, that's awesome. So that was your first surveillance, right? Way back in the day, which sounds awful. But then, like, do you remember, like, your last one?
Well, it's difficult because, we usually... When it came to the flat-out warrant work, so we do a surveillance on someone that we had a really hard tip on. And usually the whole crew that we would have with us, the teams that we had, the warrant guys, would post up in different areas of a neighborhood to try to catch a certain person who was
wanted
by us and maybe even on city warrants. We had state warrants, but a lot of these people had city warrants for robbery, for attempted assault, simple things sometimes, just not showing up for court. The warrant went in the system then, which is enough really to lock them up, but not enough to search their apartment. Our warrants, on the other hand, our felony warrants from state parole, were accessible to apartments because they were still technically doing time. So they could not ever refuse you entry to their apartment. So if that's why the cops loved it so much, because whenever they made a collar with our warrants, they got a check mark next to their name and they went right to a detective shield most of the time if they came in as regular cops. So it added onto their numbers. And so they love that stuff. So it'd be difficult. We had one guy up in Harlem, right in the middle of Harlem, Lenox Avenue, who was running wild. We could never grab him. He ran away from our guys a couple of times. This little short black guy, I can't remember his name for the life of me. But we were sitting up, different spots where he known to congregate. It was the afternoon, summer day. And one of the units says, "Hey, Mike," my boss was called Mike Murnane, Sergeant. He, because I see guys just went to it. I got the guy. I got eyeballs on him. He goes, "Where is he?" He's on Lenox on 124th. He's going into a laundromat. I said, "Fine." So we all spun around. There was like four cars, one van and three cars. Pulled up in front of this laundromat, broad daylight. Harlem is the city's premier black neighborhood. Uh-huh. Now there are white people living there, pioneers moving up there.
It's turning into like a...
It's kind of getting yuppified, man.
Yeah.
It is. I understand why, because of rents.
Yes.
But then... there was very few white people living, even standing around the street. But when we rolled up, came out of the, I mean, it was funny because we came out of the vehicles. Everybody scattered like hell. It's just funny as hell. They don't want to get involved in this stuff. So ran into the laundromat. He was yanking on the back door trying to get out, which was locked. So two of the biggest guys we got in the unit just grabbed him and...
Took him in.
Snatched him up.
Snatched him right up. And we spent days looking for this guy.
Yeah.
And that's how it played out.
What was the longest surveillance that you've ever had? Do you know or do you remember?
That the Flumer one was real rough. That because we spent a lot of man hours on that guy.
Is there anybody that you missed that you like, man, I wish we would have got that guy?
Oh, yeah. Happened. I mean, please. I mean... If we grab 30% of the warrants that we had, I'd be ecstatic.
Yeah.
And most of them, you don't find them or they outsmart you.
Yeah.
One case, this one got me really angry though. It was my case. It was in the Bronx also, Valentine Avenue. It's up on this ridgetop in the Bronx, and the 4-6 precinct up there. Anyway, it was me, my partner Tony, and a couple other guys, three or four guys. Went up and knocked on the door. I said, "Yeah, who is that?" I said, "Please, could you open the door?" And the guy opened the door, and it was the guy I'm looking for. I said, "I can't remember his name." He goes, "I said, what's your name?" He told me, I said, I have his photo. I got his, it got his pedigree card, fingerprint, everything right here. I said, that's you. He goes, yeah. I said, well, you know, you're under arrest. You're a fugitive. He goes, oh, man. He goes, all right. You got me, man. You got me. So we're all walking in. People, there were a couple people in the apartment. Guys are checking out the rooms, make sure that there was no dangers. You know, you got this clear each room. And then we went to, he goes, look, please, could I just like get my dog? He had a little small pit bull. Could I get him and just, he's tied up out there. I just want to bring him back in. I don't want to leave him out. I said, yeah, sure. Okay. Now he lived up on his ridgetop, a hill. And there was like a fence around this back patio area with spiky points on it. I'm looking down the hill and the hill went nasty, rubbly, garbage strewn hill going down to this Webster Avenue on the bottom.
Okay.
So he goes, I'm just going to bring it in. I said, okay. He picked up he unleashed the pit bull from the chain. I said, and the dog was just like this. He had the dog in his hand and he threw that dog right in my face. Bang! Knocked me right back into the wall. Next thing I look, he's going over that fence. In a matter of seconds, Mikey, what happened? I said, he threw a freaking dog in my face. I got hit with a freaking pit bull in my face, man. What the fuck? Yeah.
Right.
We're going, stop, don't you. He's running down the hill, stumbling, rolling like, over.
I can't stop now.
No. It was humiliating.
Yeah.
And I get on the radio. I said, Central, this is, Manhattan Warrants. I need a 1085, which means assistance. Because why? Because we have a fleeing fugitive on foot. Because where are you? I said, I'm on Valentine Avenue. What's the cross street? I'm looking around. I said, I don't know. There's just a big building on the corner. She goes, oh, a big building. I said, oh.
The dispatcher loved that.
No, the cops broke my balls.
Oh, yeah.
Horribly because of that. Of horribly.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, hey, Mikey, the big building on the corner. I was so rattled.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So we jumped in our car, sped down. Other units couldn't find them.
How mad are you?
I was really freaking mad.
Sure. I would be too, because I'd be like, I gave you this opportunity.
I said, I'm not going home.
The benefit of the doubt. And then,
Yeah, but see, you can't do it.
Yeah.
Can't do it. Yeah. So I told the guys, I'm not going home until we get this guy. So my partner told me, yeah, Mikey, yeah, his voice, we're going to stay. And all the guys ran on it, you know. So we found out where his girlfriend lived, did some quick research, and she was not far from there, her apartment. And
is this where he went?
Yeah.
I would not go there.
Didn't get him there either.
Oh.
Because we saw him come out of like a little alleyway. With her, she's very attractive, little chunky chick, very cute. I remember to this day, and yeah, she was. And she went into the apartment building, glass doors, and we all jumped out of the car. Stop! Don't fucking move, right? So we get to the door because we were right on him. So the door was locked. So we said, open up, I can do it, because I see him running up the stairs. And then she opened the door. So we ran in, ran upstairs, and now what do you do? There's like, what, 60, 70 apartments in there?
Yeah.
Oof. I didn't hear any doors closed. I didn't hear nothing. Went to the roof. We searched, knocked on doors. Who's going to tell you anything?
Yeah.
So he slipped us again. But then, about 2 weeks later, one of the detectives in the unit said, Mikey, that guy up on Valentine, he got collared. But it's just the uniform cops in the precinct. And I said, no kidding. I'll never forget that as long as I live. It's amazing.
Well, I've never had a dog thrown at me.
A pit bull.
And I would never throw a dog at somebody either. Like, oof,
no.
I got so respect for my dog, too. Like, I'm not using my dog as a weapon. I might in vain try to sick my dog on somebody.
Yeah.
I say in vain.
Because they won't.
She's my not dog going like, to. But
that was a crazy joke.
I'm not throwing my dog at anybody regardless.
No.
But
it's a heavy dog.
Yeah.
That was a crazy job. That job was rough, but that was funny.
Yeah. Yeah. So is that the only one that got away?
Yeah, like that, and got arrested later. But we've had guys go out windows routinely on us. And
What about just working in that environment? I mean, you're working, you know, with that lower socioeconomic community all the time, like you said, in the projects.
Yeah.
Like, did that weigh on you at all? Besides, like, because you had to see some good in there that was being stifled, I would assume. It's, you know.
Well, of course. And the good comes from the average everyday person who lives in those projects, who is most times I'm not going to sugarcoat it. There's not very many white people live in the South Bronx.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, back maybe now, but not then. Most of them are Hispanic.
Yeah.
Some black, some Hispanic. There's the black population in the Bronx is much heavier in the North Bronx. A lot of West Indian folks up there. So, but the good comes out of the people who have a symbiotic relationship with the police departments all through that city, because they get fed up. And when they get fed up, they call us.
Yeah.
They go, look, my son, my nephew, my grandson, the neighbor, he's home now. He's been stealing from my apartment for the last 3 years. Please do something about it. He's on drugs. They do it all the time. So when we get there, lots of times we'll roll right out to try to get them. And if they're still there, they're usually, they've been cracked out all night and now they're sleeping. They're just in a coma.
Yeah.
So you can cuff them while they're still sleeping. And then you say, come on, you got to go with us. And they go, oh, there's no real resistance. But it's unusual because, and sometimes it's kind of a little heartbreaking because when you're walking out, usually with, especially with Puerto Ricans, everybody starts crying.
You know, family, yeah.
Yeah. Don't hurt them. Don't hurt them, please. I said, no, man, please. You know, I thank God I learned how to speak Spanish enough where I would talk to them in Spanish and they would appreciate that. Because of my wife.
Yeah.
And I said, no. I said, yeah, we're going to put him in a program. We're going to put him in. He's got to go back. But he'll be in a program, be clean. He said, please don't hurt him. I know. I said, no. Dios te bendiga. Don't worry. You know, yeah. Means God bless you. Everything will be fine. But they would do it so often because they couldn't take the pressure.
Yeah.
Well, it's probably a big guilt trip.
Yeah.
Right? Because like with the Hispanic community, like blood is thicker than water. And so that, you know, when you turn on someone, whether it's for their own good or not, there's still that little, that nobody wants to be a snitch. Right. So that's, it just.
To a degree, I feel like nobody wants to be a snitch until push comes to shove, then everybody's
agreed,
a snitch.
Agreed. But yeah. I'm saying like in the back of their head, that might be their heartache is that shit. I did this to him because now he's being walked away in handcuffs.
In handcuffs. But you know,
but he did it to himself.
There's a balance point. There's a tipping point where these folks just can't take it anymore. And these folks don't have much. A lot of these people work in menial jobs.
Right.
They have few possessions. You go to an apartment in a project. There's not much in a all those halls are like horrible, empty bricks.
And a lot of these people are taking that long trip to that job, kind of like did as as an usher.
Exactly. Oh, exactly.
For a menial job.
Working in Manhattan.
And then you get back and then you're like, well, what the
fuck? Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. So it's a tipping point. They just can't take it anymore. And they don't want the kid to get hurt in the street. They're afraid he's going to overdose if they're blood relatives, stuff like that. And, you know, you just, I have time for another case. I'll tell you one other interesting one.
Yeah.
This one got to me a little bit because we had a warrant from this guy. Let me see. Oh, Alfonso Toro, his name was T-O-R-O, Al Toro. Okay. Now, he lived in El Barrio. El Barrio is the big traditional Puerto Rican neighborhood in northern Manhattan. Well, East Harlem in Manhattan. It's all Hispanic. Big Harlem is mostly black. So he lived there in a project there. One day, he had a nice job in a hotel. And he was a concierge or something. He was moving his way up in Midtown Manhattan. And his sister, a teenage girl, 16, she was out in the playground playing. And some guy came up to her. And started doing really, acting very, very rudely and sexually towards her and touching her. So she ran back up to the apartment and she was crying. They go, what's the matter with you? He was doing some kind of stuff in the house. And she told him, so he had a pistol in the house. So he goes, who did it? So she looked out the window, that guy. So he went downstairs and said, hey, told this guy, did you just grab my sister in a disgusting place? And they go, oh, fuck you. Boom. Killed him right then and there. Went back to the apartment. Called the cops. Himself. Said, I just shot somebody because they attacked my sister. Now, he went away for manslaughter.
Yeah.
It had to be manslaughter.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no parameter that would say it was murder.
Yeah.
So he went away for manslaughter for an emotional outburst or whatever it was. So he did his 5 or 6 years and he came back. And they didn't want him to go back to the city. They wanted him to stay in Albany. His whole family's down in the city. His mom and dad, sisters, everybody. He goes, I can't, what am I going to do up here? I go work for McDonald's. He goes, no, I'm not going to even get my hotel job back. They talked to me. He goes, no, you can't go yet. I'm not going to let you go. So he got mad. He said, the hell with it. This was like, I'll tell you. So he comes back to the city, and this was like 4 years after he got out of prison, he was in the wind. Nobody even bothered. But then, you know, the computer starts spitting out old warrants, you know, people not found, cold case stuff. Yeah. So we picked up the warrant and saw this kid. And I said, this guy, he only has one address. His family is in the Bronx. They're still there, apparently. I don't know. So the guy said, let's go check it out. So we went over to the Bronx, near the Bronxville area. And wonderful people, Puerto Rican people, real nice. Knocked on the door and said, hey, how you doing? Is Al here? Al Toro? He goes, no. He's living on the other side of the Bronx right now. You know, he's over there with his wife. He's working right now. I said, oh, but was he living here? He goes, oh, yeah. I said, I just got to ask you, is this him? We had to always have the photo. He goes, oh, yeah, that's him. Come on in. You want something to drink? You know, it's like, oh, shit. You know, really, it's like, oh. So we went in and said, look, I just want to talk to him because, you know, he was in trouble. He said, I know, but he's doing great. He's got his job back. Everything is great. I said, okay, no problem. I said, could you give me the exact address and everything so we could just go talk to him maybe tomorrow or later? He goes, yeah. So she did. And it was only maybe 20 minutes away from where they lived. So we didn't wait until the next day. What we did, I said, what time? Did he get home from work and stuff? And, you know, usually around 7 o'clock. I said, have a great day. So we went, did some stuff around the Bronx, probably went and get some food. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then at around 8 o'clock, 8:30, me and the guys rolled over and knocked on the door. And they go, yeah, hello, who's this? I said, Mikey. He goes, Mikey, yeah, open the door. How you doing? I want to see you. He goes, oh, okay. Big smile on his face. He looks at me, he goes, with the shields out and stuff. He goes, like that. Oh, I said, do it. No, please. I said, yeah, man, come on, man. He goes, please don't do this. He has his wife there, got a couple of adorable little kids. No. They just burst out crying. He goes, you can't do this to me. I said, listen, you just can't walk away from this. You know, we have the job. You did this. You walked. They wanted me to stay in Albany. I said, I know. But you just can't walk away from this. This isn't going to go away. We got to reconcile this, buddy. Come on. Oh, they're crying, and she's hanging on to him, and it's just weeping. It's just, okay. We got him in the van, and we brought him back. We processed him. We put him in the Manhattan House of Detention, which is called the Tombs. Processed him, because that's where we were going. And then he wound up at Rikers Island until his hearings. So I went to see him I went to see him while he was in Rikers Island. You made a request that you could do this, that you could write a letter. I said, so I went out there. I was doing something else. I don't know why. So I saw him. I said, look, hey, I said, I can't write a letter that you're the greatest person on this planet, but I'll write you something that said that you've been incredibly cooperative, non-resistant. You did everything right. Your family's great. You got your job back. And if they could be lenient with you, I would attest to that, and I would absolutely swear to that, that you've been a gentleman this whole time. It was thanks, Mr. Mearns. This was like around between Thanksgiving and Christmas. So Christmas week, between Christmas and New Year's, it was freezing cold. Me and Tony were coming out of the car, coming from breakfast over in the Bronx Warrant Squad, and we're walking to the door, and I see this guy standing with a leather jacket, all freezing, shaking. I'm walking over, I look at him, and he looks and goes, this. I go, what? Hey, I said, Toro. He said, yeah. I said, what are you doing? He goes, Mr. Murray, they let me out. He goes, your letter did the trick. So to me, that was like, you do one thing good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you never know what that one thing, and you know, you may have only dealt with him for a little while, but, you know, generally you can see, like, you know, if he has a job and he has a family and he's not into that lifestyle anymore, or not even lifestyle, because apparently it was
lifestyle.
Yeah, it was a one-time.
Not only that, but you also, that in itself could have, you gave the kid probably their father back, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Now, it touches me because in the midst of all this shit.
Yeah.
That you really have a chance to do something that people actually tell you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And how rare is that?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely. I did have one more question before wrapped up. Did you work there when, or in the city when they had the female mayor that they welded all the complexes up, the projects?
Female mayor?
I thought it was a female mayor. Wasn't it a female mayor?
I don't think.
We never had a female.
Maybe she was someone else.
We never had a female.
So right now, I think there's a female chief of police.
No,
not in New York City.
I watched a documentary on it, and it was like they called one of the projects like the Fortress because it was all welded up. Because she went and stayed. Maybe she was just running for mayor or something. She went
Chicago. I think
is that Chicago.
Yeah,
is that what I'm thinking of? I thought that was NYPD.
No.
Yeah.
We never had a female mayor over there.
Yeah. Ever. It must have been Chicago. It was back in like the 80s or something.
It could have been. No, yeah. We just
they welded like the doors to the project shut and stuff.
Are you serious?
She said that it was safe enough for her to stay there. And again, I don't remember if she was running for mayor or became mayor or something or some political office. And they welded it all up. But what happened was she was going to stay there till it was all cleaned up. And then obviously it never got cleaned up. And she just slowly left, you know, but then they left it all welded up. So then like all the drug dealers and stuff called it the Fortress because there was only one way in and one way out. Huh. So, and they made it that way for her. So her security detail had security on it. But then when they left, they didn't clean it all up to make it more than one way in, one way out.
That's crazy.
All right, Mike, we definitely appreciate you coming in for sure, man.
Yeah,
before we let you go, what's one piece of advice you can impart on our listeners based on your life experience?
Well, you know, living in this country, I've always loved it to the bottom of my soul, the United States. And there's a lot of reasons that people, as we see lately, getting aggravated and getting twisted around in the wrong direction. But all I could say is this. I mean, even for many of the people that I know that I've worked with, not only in the in New York City with the state and the cops, who I love, my buddies in the U.S. Air Force and the things that we did with them. If you're going to look for a hero, you're going to find it in the guy right next to you. That's it. You don't have to look far for a hero. If you associate with people who are stand-up guys with sense of morals and sense of dedicated duty, you got your hero sitting right next to you. And that's all you're going to fight for. And that's what, to me, means the most.
I like that.
That's good.
I like that for sure. Mike, we appreciate it, man.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
All right, guys, as always, if you got any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at fullgorillalife@gmail.com. Also, check us out on social media at Full Gorilla Life on Facebook and Instagram and Gorilla Full on Twitter.
And please don't forget to visit our website, fullgorilla.life, and hit subscribe in your podcast. Have a choice. Ladies and gentlemen, we out.
Later.